This is Audible.
Welcome to Bright Path Tours, and welcome to part two of our tour of Colonial Williamsburg. At the beginning of part one, we discussed a little history of the town, and I made the point that Colonial Williamsburg is here today because of the vision and the tremendous influence of two men, the Reverend William Archer Rutherford Goodwin and Mr. John D. Rockefeller. Part two begins at Bruton Parish Church, which is the large brick church on Duke of Gloucester Street, just past Market Square. Part one included stops along the north side of Duke of Gloucester, so part two will include many of the well-known places on the south side of Duke of Gloucester, and our final stop will be one of the earliest and most important buildings in Williamsburg, the Capitol. Once again, let me remind you to watch your step. The sidewalks are mostly paved with brick, and they can be uneven and slippery. Many visitors prefer to walk in the road, which has its own hazards, namely the horses and horse-drawn carriages. If you happen to end up behind one of those, do be careful and watch where you're stepping. If you're not there yet, please pause the tour until you reach our first stop, Bruton Parish Church. Before Williamsburg became Williamsburg, when the area was still known as Middle Plantation, a number of parishes were combined, establishing Bruton Parish in 1674. Bruton is named for a town in Somerset, England, which happened to be the family seats of both the Ludwells and Berkeleys, two of the very influential families of early Virginia. The first Bruton Parish Church was built near the site of the present church in 1683. From the first vestry book of the parish, we know that a builder by the name of Francis Page was paid £150, plus £60 of good, sweet-scented tobacco for his work here. The pastor of the church was the esteemed Reverend Rowland Jones. The good reverend's pay consisted of either tobacco or promissory notes based on tobacco. Tobacco payments also extended into the general population. For instance, when someone died, it would cost you £3 of tobacco to register the death, and another £10 to have the sexton dig the grave. If you were a person of higher standing and desired burial within the church itself, that would set you back either a half ton of tobacco, or you could take the easier route and just pay £5 sterling. And by the way, Jones's great-granddaughter is a woman we know well. Her name was Martha Washington. In 1699, the capital of the Virginia colony is moved from Jamestown to Middle Plantation and renamed Williamsburg in honor of King William III. By then, the College of William and Mary had been founded. With the moving of the capital and the opening of the college, this area became a much busier place. By the early 1700s, it was apparent that a new church was necessary to accommodate the growing population. Building the new church, however, required a petition to both the House of Burgesses and to the royal governor, Alexander Spotswood. By 1710, the cost of such a building would amount to £200, payable out of a tax on liquor and slaves. Yes, you heard that correctly, liquor and slaves. This seems to have been the common base of income for this part of the colony, as taxes on those two sources were frequently used for needed funds. Governor Spotswood himself was asked to design the new church, which would be completed by 1715. As the town prospered, so did Bruton Parish, and by the mid-1700s, the decision was made to add a steeple to the church. The person hired for that work was none other than the local builder, Benjamin Powell, who we visited in the first tour. At that time, Powell was a very busy man. His work during the mid-1700s included repairs to both the jail and the capital, and he was embarking on the construction of the public hospital. So you get the idea that Powell is a respected builder around town. This steeple, actually it's a bell tower, is the first of its kind in Virginia. Note the iron weather vane at the top of the tower. It is believed that it dates to 1769, about the time that the tower was built. And the bell was a gift, donated in 1761 by James Tarpley, whose store we will see shortly. The first organist of Bruton Parish was Peter Pelham. A well-known and respected musician, Pelham also helped install the organ. His stipend of £25 per year, though, was not sufficient to support a growing family, so he also became the town's jailer, taking up residence in the jail. As the town's jailer, Pelham was known to bring a prisoner or two with him to services, not necessarily to save the prisoner's soul, but to pump the air for the organ. Another interesting point about Peter Pelham: when Pelham's father remarried, Pelham became the stepbrother to the renowned artist John Singleton Copley. In 1903, a new rector arrived who would begin his own revolution that would result in the town of Williamsburg, the Reverend William Archer Rutherford Goodwin. But before that historic notion took hold, Goodwin began a much-needed restoration of the church itself. That first restoration was completed in 1907. The church would receive a good deal of attention during the restoration of the town in the 1930s. In recognition of his immeasurable contributions to colonial Williamsburg, Goodwin is buried inside the church. Today, almost 350 years after the first church was erected, Bruton Parish Church continues to serve Williamsburg. While you're visiting, be sure to stop by and talk with the knowledgeable volunteers and see the many memorials lining the walls. And be sure to look for the plaque that honors the visionary, Reverend Dr. Goodwin. Speaking of burials, we're going to take a quick stroll around the burial ground where you can view some of the final resting places of Williamsburg notables. From the church records, we can estimate that there are about 30 burials within the church building. The number of burials in the graveyard can only be estimated, however, because so many early burials were either marked poorly or not marked at all. During the 17th and 18th centuries, families might choose to bury their dead in a place closer to home rather than in a churchyard. Frequently, the burial would take place in a small plot on the family property. Even here in Williamsburg, that was the case. As more families settled on farms and plantations, those burial plots increased in number, and often they were quite far from the local church. How do you think the local ministers felt about having to visit these far-flung places to perform a burial service? Obviously, they would not have enjoyed these treks. And in Williamsburg, we have complaints from the Reverend Hugh Jones, who tired of having to travel long distances. So, eventually, we'll see burials taking place in and near the local church, even though the practice of home burials continued for quite some time. You can't help but notice the substantial brick wall that surrounds these grounds. That wall dates to the 1750s, and it exists today because of a memorial gift. To honor her 11-year-old daughter, Catherine, who had died, Cynthia Beverly Tucker Coleman invited her daughter's young friends to form the Catherine Memorial Society. The group used their training in stitchery, selling their work to raise funds for Bruton Parish Church. Eventually, they raised enough money to repair the brick wall that surrounds the churchyard. The Memorial Society's interest in preservation led to the establishment of the Association for the Preservation of Virginia Antiquities, or the APVA. And that association would eventually provide a number of the buildings that would become part of Williamsburg's restoration. Bruton Parish Church and Graveyard can be a complete tour unto themselves, but it's time for us to move on and continue up the street to the home of John Blair. On our way to the Blair home, you'll notice an old but stately brick home on your right. This is the Bowdoin Armistead House. Lemuel Bowdoin was a lawyer who also served as president of the Board of Overseers for the nearby public hospital, which is another stop on this tour. Bowdoin was called the Virginia Yankee by many locals, who considered him a Union sympathizer during the Civil War. In fact, his mother lived here on the property as well, but she occupied a small dwelling behind the house. An ardent secessionist, Lemuel's mother refused to live with her Virginia Yankee son. The house was purchased by Robert Armistead in the mid-1870s. By the time that John D. Rockefeller and William Goodwin had begun the restoration of Williamsburg, a descendant and local judge, Frank Armistead, lived here. At first, Judge Armistead was amenable to a restoration of the town, but his opinion quickly changed. Not only would he be against the restoration and all activities related to the restoration, he was opposed to John D. Rockefeller in particular. The house has remained outside of the historic interpretation and sits by itself, a part of the town and yet not part of the town, a kind of time capsule in its own right. As you continue walking on Duke of Gloucester Street, when you reach Nassau Street, you'll see one of the many pastures that dot the local landscape, and often you'll see some of the animals that reside in Colonial Williamsburg. Some of these animals are part of the Rare Breeds program, and if you're lucky, you might see the large, beautiful oxen that pull carts around town. Or you might see some of the horses that pull the touring carriages. At times, you might see and hear the sheep that occupy various locations. So be sure to pause and check out the pasture. After the pasture, coming up on your right will be the John Blair House, an historic home owned by an historic figure, and a home that was almost demolished before it could be saved. John Blair, Sr., was the nephew of the Reverend James Blair, the man who established the College of William and Mary. John Blair, Sr. was a busy man. Not only did he serve as rector of Bruton Parish Church, he was president of the College of William and Mary, a member of the House of Burgesses, and he served as the Auditor General for almost 50 years. As Auditor General, Blair was the man who kept track of tax income. As a member of the House of Burgesses, Blair was an active participant in the actions that led to the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution. When the royal governor, Lord Botetou, dissolved the House of Burgesses for the first time in 1769, Blair was among the men who repaired to the Raleigh Tavern to continue their meetings. When Blair died, the house passed to his son, John Blair, Jr., in 1773. John Blair, Jr. was esteemed in his own right. He was a signer of the Constitution, and he was also appointed to the first United States Supreme Court by George Washington. The home is one of the oldest in Williamsburg, and one of the least altered from the time it was built. But, like some of the other homes in town, such as the Peyton Randolph home and the Coke Garrett house, the house was expanded over time. The original section is the east, or right side of the house, built in the early 1720s, making it a very early building indeed. The home was expanded about 20 years later to accommodate a large room for entertaining. It is interesting that Blair created that edition in the 1730s, which is about 25 years before the idea caught on at other buildings like Raleigh Tavern, Peyton Randolph's, and the Governor's Palace. As I mentioned, the house was almost torn down to make way for some other type of commercial building or for a service station, one of many in town in the early 20th century. Fortunately, a member of the faculty at the college stepped in and purchased the house in order to preserve it. Then, at Christmas in 1923, only a few years before he would team up with John D. Rockefeller, Reverend William Goodwin and a group of men purchased the home. The property would then be added to the Colonial Williamsburg portfolio in 1928. The house remained in the Blair family until the years just before the Civil War. After that, the house saw various uses until the purchase by William and Mary faculty member Jonathan Garland Pollard, who saved the property from demolition. By the way, the attorney who handled the sale was Vernon Getty, a descendant of the Getty family who owned the foundry just up the street. As I mentioned earlier, the property was conveyed to William Goodwin and Colonial Williamsburg in 1928. We're going to leave this side of Duke of Gloucester Street now and head over to the south side of town, where we'll see the public hospital, one of the earliest mental institutions in America. From the Blair home, let's retrace our steps and walk back to Nassau Street. At Nassau, cross Duke of Gloucester Street, then continue down Nassau until you reach the corner of Nassau and Francis Street. From there, you'll be able to view the public hospital. While we walk over to the hospital, let's talk about the layout of the town. So far, we've walked along the sidewalks that line Duke of Gloucester Street. However, if you were here back in the 1700s, you would not have seen these sidewalks. That's because they didn't exist. Similar to other towns in Virginia and Maryland, by the late 1600s, a requirement was imposed on anyone owning a lot within Williamsburg. Within 2 years after purchasing that lot, the owner was to build a house. The house was to be 20 by 30 feet, and it was to sit 6 feet from the street. An additional requirement was added. The lot was to be enclosed by some type of fencing. If the owner did not comply with this requirement within 6 months of building on the lot, they would be required to pay a penalty of 5 shillings per month, not a small sum for many inhabitants. So, thinking about the fact that the house was to be 6 feet from the street, that requirement would have eliminated the sidewalks we have today. The sidewalks are actually someone's idea of what you'd see in a picturesque colonial town. However, on a practical note, the Williamsburg Foundation realized that they would need to safely accommodate the many visitors that were expected. So instead of keeping the original design with no sidewalks, we have spacious areas that lead us from site to site. By now, you should have crossed Duke of Gloucester Street, and you should be very near the corner of Nassau and Francis Street. As you look across Francis Street, you'll see the large green field in front of the public hospital. It was also called the public asylum, by the way. On your right, near the corner of Francis Street, you'll also see a small cleared lot. That lot is the site of the original and historic First Baptist Church. A man named Gowan Pamphlet, who had been a slave working at the King's Arms Tavern, would become the best known of the preachers in Williamsburg, and he went on to lead the Baptist Church here when it was nothing more than a wooden structure on this plot across from the hospital. We don't need to walk all the way over to the hospital building, so feel free to stay near the corner of Nassau and Francis Streets, or walk up as close to the building as you'd like. The building you're looking at represents the original public hospital building, completed in 1773, the year that the first patients were accepted. It was the first public hospital whose sole purpose was the care of the mentally ill, and it spans the history of treatment of mental disabilities. The first years of the hospital were part of the age of restraint, which needs no explanation. Treatment and care evolved until we reach the moral management era in the mid-1830s, a promising time in mental health care where restraint gave way to compassion and emphasis on the arts and social activity. But then, by the late 1800s, that care had slipped backwards into the custodial care period, where you'd find patients restrained once again. Social activities continued during that time, but the hospital was no longer considered a treatment facility, instead becoming a kind of warehouse where the needs of the mentally ill would be attended, but without attempts for a cure. The man who built the hospital was local resident and undertaker Benjamin Powell, whose work we've already seen at the bell tower of Bruton Parish Church. Besides the bell tower, Powell also did work at the Capitol and the jail. For these buildings, he was considered the undertaker, which sounds a little strange. Today, we know undertakers as those people who take care of dead bodies. In the 18th century, however, the undertaker was the man who was a building contractor, the man who undertook contracts to build things. The idea of such a hospital was first proposed by Royal Governor Francis Fauquier in 1766. Fauquier was a fitting champion. Considered an intellectual and aligning himself with the intellectual community, his interests included philosophy and the sciences, as well as music and the arts. At that time, he stated the need for such a place, as he said, "for these miserable objects who cannot help themselves." It is the first hospital in America that was dedicated to those who suffered all manner of mental afflictions. Until the advent of these hospitals, or asylums as they were called, the mentally ill were frequently found with other wards of the parish, homeless orphans, social outcasts, the destitute. In other words, the lowest of the low in the social order. The lucky ones might be found at home with family bearing the burden of their care. One such person who bore that burden was none other than Patrick Henry. When his wife showed signs of what was then called extreme melancholy after she gave birth to their sixth child, Henry arranged for two slaves to attend her, something that middling society would not have been able to afford. She would be cared for in a basement room that Henry himself had outfitted. Windows in the room provided her with light and air. She would be cared for until her death, never recovering from this mental illness. At the public hospital, the inmates were treated with everything from opiates to laxatives to bleeding, or they might also be subjected to the plunge bath, where the entire body was immersed in cold water, in the hope that either their mania would be calmed or that they would be energized out of lethargy. But for the most part, and for many hours of the day, they remained alone, sometimes allowed out into the yard for fresh air. That yard was referred to as the Mad Yard. The local blacksmiths also played a role here. They would install iron restraints to be used on those who were considered more dangerous or who could not be trusted if they were left alone. You might be wondering how these unfortunates were admitted to this hospital. That decision was the responsibility of a board of overseers that included some of the town's leaders, men like John Blair Jr., George Wythe, and the Randolph brothers, Peyton and John, sat on this board of directors and decided who should be admitted and, more importantly, who should be released. There were two basic requirements for admittance. The person either had to be a danger to themselves or others, or they had to be considered curable. These requirements existed because the directors did not want a facility that would mimic the jail, nor did they want the hospital used for long-term care. By 1833, the property consisted of four buildings. During that time, the hospital would be renamed the Williamsburg Lunatic Asylum. Eventually, it became the Eastern Lunatic Asylum. And by then, medical advancements for the mentally ill had expanded to more humane treatment. Under Dr. John Minson Galt II, that treatment included social activities, art, and music. Galt, who was the grandson of the man who owned the Pastor and Galt Apothecary over near Raleigh Tavern, also joined a new medical organization that eventually became the American Psychiatric Association. In general, and in particular here in Williamsburg, he can be credited with compassionate care that eased the suffering of these inmates. Unfortunately, Dr. Galt sided with the South during the Civil War, so you can understand that when the Northern troops arrived in town in 1862, Galt needed something to calm his nervous condition. So he turned to his own stores for treatment, creating the common sedative that he used for his patients, a mix of alcohol and opium. The mixture proved lethal. Poor Dr. Galt died using his own medicine. By the mid-1800s and the Civil War, the hospital consisted of 9 buildings and 300 patients. But the occupying Union Army would not treat the place kindly. By the end of the war, the buildings required extensive repair, and the hospital itself would need to be resupplied. For those who might wonder how many soldiers and civilians might have been mentally affected by the war, you need look no further than this hospital. Here, you would find many whose mental breakdowns were caused by the recent war. In 1885, fire destroyed the main building, but by then, the hospital had become part of the warehousing movement. Mental treatment had taken a step backwards when patients were sent away to be stored in an institution. The term, sent to Williamsburg, implied a point of no return for the mental patient. The building was rebuilt, and the hospital would remain active on this site until the institution was removed in the 1960s to a site just outside of town. At that time, the old building complex was torn down. The building that is here today was reconstructed in 1985, 100 years after the fire, on the original site and using the design of the original building. You also see that the building now serves as the entry to the DeWitt Wallace Decorative Arts Museum. Since both of these sites are worth a longer visit, make note to return and visit both the old hospital and the arts museum. From the hospital, let's walk back to Duke of Gloucester Street and visit a building that served as both home and shop. The Tolliver Coal House that sits at the corner of Nassau and Duke of Gloucester. To get there, cross Nassau Street first, then walk back to Duke of Gloucester and turn right. It's the large white house at the corner. By the way, the pronunciation and actual spelling of the name Tolliver do not match. The name is actually spelled T-A-L-I-A-F-E-R-R-O, Tolliver. Just so you know. Charles Tolliver was a prosperous merchant in Williamsburg, but he was also a well-known coachmaker. He was actually one of a number of coachmakers here, all of whom appeared to have lived and worked in this part of town. In addition, Tolliver owned a number of boats that he used for trade along the nearby rivers, procuring goods that he would sell in the store. Much of the exterior of the Tolliver Coal House is original, and the interior sports the original staircase and flooring. Restoration took place in the early 1940s. Similar to some of the other houses we've seen in town, the Tolliver Coal House was built in two sections. The right side was built in the late 1700s, when Charles Tolliver lived and worked here, and the left side was built in the early 1800s. Researchers and historians conclude that the house was built as a two-story home, which would have been quite large for a dwelling at the time. However, the bottom portion was most probably a store and counting room. The upstairs would have been the family dwelling. The house was only part of Tolliver's property, as he also owned adjoining lots that contained buildings that would have supported the coachmaking business. Such a business would have required various supporting secondary businesses such as leather making and a forge. From an article in the Virginia Gazette, we know that Tolliver lost at least one of his buildings in a fire. The fire was started by a spark from the forge. The forge, apparently, was part of the stable that also contained a hayloft. Fire and hay on the same site? Not a good mix. Not only did the fire consume the forge and stable building, Tolliver lost a horse, lumber, and a new coach, most certainly a serious loss for his business. Sometime around the 1800s, it appears that Tolliver joined in business with Jesse Cole, and by 1805, Cole owned the property. Cole became postmaster a few years later, and for the next 25 years or so, he operated a business here that included a hodgepodge of items. In addition to operating the post office, Cole sold dry goods, books, foods, medicines, and you could even buy French brandy. Oh, and he also rented out rooms to some of the college students. The Cole family would continue to own the house until 1939, when Colonial Williamsburg would acquire the property. However, Cole descendants, like others around town, were given a life estate in the property, allowing them to remain in the home. Next door to the home is the Tolliver Cole Shop, which was home at one time to the Virginia Gazette. If you've taken the Part 1 tour, you'll recall that there were three Virginia Gazettes all operating here in town at the same time. The shop was one of the buildings whose front was severely modified. In the late 1800s, a two-story, square, flat facade was stuck onto the front of the building, making it look like something out of a movie set. The facade was removed during the restoration in 1940. Look at the sidewalk in front of the shop. Depending on the season, there is usually a set of benches outside, and near the benches, you'll see a stone in the sidewalk dedicated to the Pulaski Club. The Pulaski Club, named for the revered Revolutionary War general Casimir Pulaski, was established here in Williamsburg in 1779. Members met in front of the coal shop, or during the colder months, the club would meet in the shop. The initiation fee for the Pulaski Club was a quart of Virginia whiskey. One of the best-known members of the club was none other than John D. Rockefeller himself, who joined in 1950. Membership is limited to 34 men to commemorate Pulaski's age at the time of his death. The Pulaski Club, along with Phi Beta Kappa, is one of the earliest clubs founded in America. Let's continue up Duke of Gloucester Street to the John Custis Tenement. The Custis Tenement is the first building after you pass the large garden that serves as the garden center. As we walk there, let's talk a little about the importance of gardens in the colonial era. Gardens were important in all of the colonies during the colonial era, and they served a dual purpose: as a year-round source of food for families, and as a source of pleasant enjoyment of nature and natural settings. Just as needlework and painting were part of a young woman's education, gardening and botany were part of a young man's education, and here in Williamsburg, we are the beneficiaries of this training and interest. The first book on American gardens was written here by a man whose family was well known in the colony. The author was John Randolph, the last Royal Attorney General for Virginia. And John Custis, who we'll visit shortly, took a keen interest in a variety of plants and readily traded seeds and information. When it came time to plan the restoration of the colonial gardens, the man chosen for the job was the highly respected Arthur A. Shercliffe. To give you an idea of his standing, Shercliffe was one of the founders of Harvard School of Landscape Architecture. But he also had his own ideas of what beautiful gardens should look like, and those ideas did not always reflect colonial-era gardens. Then again, not a lot of landscape architects and gardeners actually knew what a colonial garden would contain. So the gardens in town were created, not with great historic accuracy, but they earned such high praise that they quickly became part of the Williamsburg experience. Besides his lack of concern over historic gardening, Arthur Shercliffe was also not the type of person to pay close attention to budgets. There is a story of the time he was discussing the palace gardens with John Rockefeller, who asked repeatedly what the cost would be. Finally, the normally quiet Rockefeller shouted at Shercliffe, "What is the cost?" To which Shercliffe finally replied, "Between $200,000 and $500,000. Rockefeller laughed at that and said, "Oh well, let's just appropriate $1 million and go to lunch." Fortunately for us, the small army of researchers, botanists, arborists, and everyone else related to gardening here in Williamsburg has done a marvelous job recreating the gardens, this time as they would have looked during the 1700s and 1800s. By now, you should be close to the John Custis tenement, a small white house that belies the holdings and influence of the man who would be Martha Custis Washington's first father-in-law. John Custis IV was a wealthy man who owned multiple plantations in Virginia. He served on the Governor's Council and was an early member of the House of Burgesses, settling in Williamsburg in the early 1700s, building his first home here by 1717. One of the properties that he inherited from his grandfather was Arlington, a large home and property on Virginia's eastern shore. John's great-grandson would take that name for a home that he would build near Mount Vernon. That building, called Arlington House, is part of Arlington National Cemetery today. An eccentric man, Custis also appears to have been a cruel man and a tyrant of a father. The words loving and caring are not part of a description of his parental qualities. John's son, Daniel, had been stymied in his attempts at marriage, but he was determined to marry a young woman named Patsy Dandridge. Patsy was her nickname. Her name was Martha, Martha Dandridge, who would have the courage to stand up to John Custis and eventually marry Daniel, and then, after Daniel's death, would marry George Washington. Even though records indicate that he received an education in England, John's early life hints at loneliness and a lack of family support, and it looks like his marriage didn't really help his outlook. John married a beautiful, wealthy young woman from the Park family. Her name was Frances Park, who he called Fidelia. Unfortunately, both possessed extremely volatile tempers and a lack of restraint that was unheard of during this time of genteel manners and dignified society. In fact, at one point, they drew up an agreement that stated that Custis would support the family well as long as Frances would refrain from using abusive and disparaging language. When Frances died at age 28, she left behind a daughter and son, and that was the end of marriage for John Custis. But that wasn't the end of the children. John would father a son with one of his slaves, a son he named John, who he nurtured and cared for, and even ensured that he would be treated well after his death. Custis freed John in 1748. During his time here, Custis acquired additional properties and built additional buildings to rent out, called tenements. When he rented out one of his properties to a carpenter, he required the tenant to ensure that the chimney was kept clean to prevent fire, reminding us of the constant threat when fire was the main source of heating, cooking, and many trades. Besides taking care of his vast holdings and spending time emotionally abusing his children, Custis spent the majority of his time indulging his interests in gardening and cultivating rare and exotic plants, clearly one of his favorite activities. In fact, he was well known in the colony for his expertise and enthusiasm for gardening, and regularly entertained and corresponded with some of the great horticulturists of the day. Here in Williamsburg, his extensive garden rivaled the governor's palace, encompassing 4 acres and containing all types of trees, shrubs, and plants. After John Custis died in 1749, Martha Custis and then George Washington administered the properties until Martha's son, Jackie, reached maturity. The house burned in 1776, so the structure you see today is a reconstruction and is used by Bruton Parish Church. For such a small house, there is a lot of history here. Let's move on now to the prosperous business owned by John Greenough, the Greenough Store. John Greenough had a number of properties in this area, and the first building that we'll pass is the Greenough Lumber House, whose name is somewhat misleading to modern usage. This small building was used not for wood. Don't be fooled by the term lumber house. During the 1700s, such a building was simply a place for storage. Lumber meant items in storage. And here, Greenough would have kept his stores of goods that might have been too large to include in the shop. Items such as barrels or pieces of furniture, anything that would have crowded the store, would have been kept here. After the lumber house is the Greenough house and store, which looks like one large building. The store on the left is the most complete representation of a store and business in colonial Williamsburg, with the layout, the display shelves, the counting room, all arranged as they would have been during the colonial era. Greenough owned an 8-ton schooner that docked in the nearby James River that ran between here and Philadelphia, trading local provisions for such varied goods as iron, soap, furniture, flour, dishwares, and coffee, among many other items that would be sold in the store. In the Part 1 tour, we discussed the difference between a shop and a store. The store offered a variety of items for sale, whereas the shop sold the items made by a craftsman on the premises. Note the proximity of Greenough's store to Market Square. Because he was so close to the bustling market center of town, you get the idea that his business would have been quite successful. Next door to the Greenough store is the shoemaker. For many years, the shoemaker trade has been housed here, but Colonial Williamsburg sometimes moves the trades from location to location around town. Considering the different trades represented in Williamsburg gives us a good opportunity to have a short discussion of an important part of the trades, the use of apprentices and indentured servants. Both the apprentice and indentured servant worked under specific agreements or contracts for a specific period. Here in Williamsburg, that period might be 4 to 7 years, but the time frames varied widely. They were given room and board and other necessities in exchange for their services. Often, those services allowed them to learn a trade or craft, such as shoemaking, cabinetry, blacksmithing, or even bookkeeping. And later, they had the opportunity to become a journeyman, or, if they were very lucky, they might even become a master and own the business. Well, we're now ready to move on to another of the very early public buildings in town, The Powder Magazine. The Powder Magazine is in Market Square, and it's hard to miss since it is the only eight-sided brick building in town. It will be on your right near the Market House. The Powder Magazine, with its perfect geometric proportions, is one of the most picturesque buildings in town. Don't let its small size fool you, though. Besides being a beautiful little building, it was also one of the most important buildings in Williamsburg. Some type of arsenal or magazine has existed here from the early days of the colony. Before the capital was moved from Jamestown, while this place was still known as Middle Plantation, a magazine had been built in the area. That was in the late 1600s. The reason this building even exists is because of the Queen. At that time, it was Queen Anne. Sometime around 1714, Royal Governor Alexander Spotswood had asked for and received a gift of arms and ammunition from the Queen. In 1715, he reported the gift to the House of Burgesses and requested that a building be erected to store the valuable armaments. The cost of the building was about £200, to be paid for, in part, from the tax on slaves and liquor. The Powder Magazine would be completed by 1716. Fast forward to late April 1775. If you remember the poem, Paul Revere's Ride, you'll recall that the battles of Lexington and Concord took place on April 19th. Here in Williamsburg, the town would not have heard of the battles yet, but during the night of April 20th, 1775, Lord Dunmore, feeling threatened by the growing unrest in the Virginia colony, ordered his men to remove the gunpowder from the magazine. With that, the magazine took on a different role. Up to that point, it was a supply of arms and ammunition for defense of the colony. After that night, the magazine became a symbol of the governor's and Britain's oppression of the colony. Patrick Henry, who had recently made his proclamation, "Give me liberty or give me death," marched a group of volunteers to the town, demanding the return of the stores. With these ominous actions, the local newspaper, the Virginia Gazette, stated, "The sword is now drawn, and God knows when it will be sheathed." Royal Governor Dunmore would eventually try to make amends, paying for the gunpowder, but by then, as the saying goes, the horse was out of the barn. During the evening of June 8, 1775, Lord Dunmore, realizing that his time was up here, quickly and quietly removed his family from Williamsburg and boarded a British warship that was docked in the nearby York River. That action ended the role of the royal governor in Virginia and marked the end of British rule in the colony. The magazine would continue to serve its important role throughout the Revolutionary War years, but after the war, when the capital moved to Richmond, its importance as an armory ceased to exist. With the exception of the Civil War years in the 1860s, the building was no longer used to store armaments. Instead, from the late 17 to the late 1800s, the building saw various uses as a church, a stable, a market house, and at one time it was even a school for dance instruction. By the late 1800s, a sense of preserving Virginia's past was beginning. In 1888, a preservation group, the group I mentioned back at Bruton Parish Church, the Association for the Preservation of Virginia Antiquities, also called the APVA, was founded here in Williamsburg, and the Powder Magazine was their first project. In 1889, the association stepped in to save the deteriorating building, but before they could completely assume responsibility, a nearby fire spread to the building, destroying the roof and leaving a ruined shell to sit forlorn on Market Square. The building was restored by Colonial Williamsburg in 1934. However, the APVA still owned the property. it would be another 50 years before the Williamsburg Foundation would finally take ownership, completing the purchase in 1986. The Powder magazine certainly played an important role in town, providing military necessities of the day. But so did the building we'll see next. The Market House was the peaceful counterpart to its neighbor here on Market Square, serving the public with domestic necessities of the day. Let's take the short walk across Market Square to one of Williamsburg's newest sites, the open-air Market House. The Market Square is basically the open green space on both sides of Duke of Gloucester Street. So important were these places that all colonial towns would have had some type of central area where goods could be bought or traded, and in fact, a market has been in this area since the time of the earliest settlement. It was and remains today one of the busiest places in town, and during its entire existence has served as a place where local goods were promoted, where important trade took place, where various military units trained, where arms and ammunition were stored, and where important announcements were made. If you were passing by the courthouse in the 1770s, you might have seen political proclamations placed on the doors, and you might have been one of the town residents gathering to read them, never realizing that you would soon hear a reading of the document that would proclaim America's freedom from Great Britain. That's right. The Declaration of Independence would be read from the very courthouse steps that you see at the courthouse at the center of Market Square today. In Williamsburg, Wednesdays and Saturdays were the designated market days, and here you would find every level of society buying and selling. Eventually, the Market Square evolved into a daily marketplace. But twice a year, in December and April, the townspeople enjoyed a fair that lasted for 3 days, and in addition to the regular market day offerings, would include all sorts of festive activities and social gatherings. The fair days were much anticipated, and the Virginia Gazette even included regular reports of the goings-on. Take a minute and imagine that you are at the fair. Walking around, you might see prizes being awarded for the best draft horses, or to the farmers who brought the largest number of sheep or pigs. The Virginia Gazette, reporting on a contest held during the fair of December 1739, reported on a race for the men to be run all the way down Duke of Gloucester Street from the college to the Capitol. The first prize was a pair of silver buckles. Second prize was a pair of shoes, and third prize was a pair of gloves. The Gazette went on to report on a contest to catch a pig by the tail. The tail, by the way, was made slippery with soap. The prize was the pig itself, awarded to the person who could not only catch him, but pick him up completely off the ground by the tail. Today, you can bet that such an event would be attended by some very vocal protesters. The Market House itself is a new building and a new interpretation of the early building that was here. Such a building is known to have existed since the mid-1700s. This structure has been rebuilt on the original site of the early Market House. As they recreated the building, the craftsmen decided to add a colored pigment to the tar that covers the roof. They felt that, since this was a public place, they would make the building look a little nicer. From here, we're going to continue our walk up Duke of Gloucester Street toward the Capitol. So, facing the Market House, turn left, and let's walk over to the building that adjoins Market Square, the Market Square Tavern. The building sits just across the street from Chuning's Tavern. Market Square Tavern was also referred to as an ordinary, which is just another word for tavern. It sits on property that was originally part of Market Square. It is one of the 88 original buildings that survive to the present day. Originally owned by the trustees of Williamsburg and leased in 1749, this property has changed hands many times. Dr. John Dixon was the first person to lease the property, and he built a store here. A subsequent owner expanded the property and offered overnight lodging as well. Thomas Jefferson himself rented rooms here while he studied law with George Wythe, whose home over on Palace Green was a stop during part one of our tour. In 1771, Gabriel Maupin, a saddler and harness maker, purchased the property and announced the purchase in the Virginia Gazette. Maupin stated that he was making considerable additions and improvements with the best entertainment and accommodations. It seems that everyone who advertised their tavern business here had the best entertainment and accommodations. At the same time, Maupin announced that he was moving his saddle and harness-making business to the property. His building sits next door to the Market Square Tavern. To give you an idea of how owners turned simple properties into taverns, here are some of the additions that were necessary in order to accommodate travelers of all type. The tavern keeper would have to offer a stable for multiple horses, since that was the mode of transportation. They would have to store food for both the animals and the lodgers. Hence, Maupin advertised a large fodder loft and a very good kitchen, a good garden, and most important in a populated area, an excellent well of water. As an added bonus, Maupin also noted his large smokehouse. Maupin's tavern was an inviting place indeed, so inviting that members from a local Masonic lodge met and stayed here. As was the custom of the day, Maupin also offered lectures and other such enjoyments. Gabriel Maupin died around 1800, but during his time as tavern keeper and business owner here, he was apparently quite prosperous, since it's noted that the Market Square Tavern survived not only the economic hardships during and after the Revolutionary War, it continued in business even after the capital picked up and moved to Richmond in the late 1700s. Restoration of the building began in 1931 and was completed in 1932. The tavern now serves as one of Colonial Williamsburg's guest properties, so make note to look this up if you're planning a return visit. If you're ready to move on, we're going to cross Queen Street, continue up the block, then cross Colonial Street, and visit the Orlando Jones House. It's the first house on the corner after you cross Colonial Street. With the Orlando Jones House, we have another direct connection to the Custis and Washington families. Martha Dandridge Custis, who would marry George Washington, was the granddaughter of Orlando Jones. Similar to many other properties in town, this property changed hands many times, but records indicate that the original owner of the lots was Orlando Jones, whose father, Rowland, was the first minister of Bruton Parish Church. According to the records, the property was conveyed by the town to Jones in 1716, making this one of the oldest properties in Williamsburg. Jones built his home and lived here with his second wife, Mary. During that time, he served in the House of Burgesses until his death in 1719. In his will, he left Mary his best feather bed and the saddle for her horse. Oh, and he also left her a slave and all future children that the slave may have. Orlando Jones and his first wife, Martha, are buried at Bruton Parish Church. After Orlando's death, Mary sold the lots to a watchmaker, Mr. John James Flournoy. That was 1720. Things seemed to move a little faster in the 1700s than we imagine today, because shortly after Mary sold the property, she married Flournoy. They remained in the house and in Williamsburg for another 10 years, but left in 1730 when, once again, the house changed hands. Before we leave this site, let me point out an important element of many building designs of this period: balance and symmetry. At the Orlando Jones House, you can easily see what I'm talking about. You have a door in the center of the building and an equal number of windows on either side. And above that, you have those three windows called dormers spaced equally across the roof. On both ends of the roof, you have a chimney. Not only was balance and symmetry important in architecture, it was important to many other aspects of life in the colonial era, in decoration, modes of dress, in military exercise, and even on the all-important dinner table. A well-set dining table would have the same types of serving bowls and dishes mirroring each other at opposite ends of the table. So keep this in mind as you walk around town. The Orlando Jones House is a reconstruction, which was completed in 1940. Let's continue to the house next door. Originally, the owner of the plot was Orlando Jones, but today it's known as the Mary Stith House. Although this is a small, rather humble home, there is an interesting story associated with the owner, Mary Stith. The name is spelled S-T-I-T-H, by the way. Mary's father, William Stith, served as president of the College of William and Mary in the mid-1750s and wrote a book titled The History of the First Discovery and Settlement of Virginia, which is considered the first history book of its kind published in America. Mary never married. However, her sister Elizabeth married a prominent man in town, Dr. William Pasteur, of the Pasteur and Galt Apothecary. Records for this property are incomplete, but we know that Mary lived in town by the 1760s, and that she probably owned this property by the 1780s. The record also shows that she owned a number of slaves, and therein lies the interesting story. By the late 1700s, Mary started freeing her slaves, beginning with two young men in their 20s and a young woman and her two children. Also, by that time, apparently, Mary's property included at least three buildings and furnishings. In her remarkable will of 1813, she provided for her freed slaves when she stated the following: "I think it my duty not to leave them destitute, nor to leave them unrecompensed for past services rendered to me." With only a couple of exceptions, she left her entire estate to her freedmen and women, saying that it was a payment of her just debts. In 1842, a massive fire destroyed many of the buildings in this block, including Mary Stith's property. Up through the late 1800s, this part of town remained vacant, with only the foundations visible. When it rained, the foundations filled with water, creating small lakes where young boys would sail their toy boats. In the winter, you'd find them ice skating here. Another of the properties that burned in that conflagration was the home right next door. It was the home of James Anderson, a blacksmith, who ran a large blacksmithing operation. So let's take a look at this fascinating compound that was called the Colonial Armory. By 1765, 25-year-old James Anderson had already earned a reputation as a fine blacksmith, and in fact, had been appointed as the armorer to the town armory, the magazine. 5 years later, in 1770, Anderson acquired this property and began building his armory business in earnest. Then, in 1775, he was named public armorer, responsible for maintaining all of the arms and armaments of the Commonwealth of Virginia. At that time, patriot and founding father Richard Henry Lee stated, "It is vain to have good systems of government and good laws if we are exposed to the ravage of the sword without means of resisting." James Anderson provided that means of resistance. He would serve the Commonwealth throughout the Revolutionary War. As you might guess, this was a busy, busy place. Think about the types of supplies Anderson's shop would have produced if he were just the town blacksmith. Every day, you would have seen the workers turn out such mundane items as hinges, tools, household items, and since this was largely a farming area, a variety of farming tools would have been produced here as well. By colonial era standards, Anderson mass-produced all of these items. And how about nails? Every type of building in town needed nails. Carts and wagons and richly fitted carriages needed nails. Fences, doors, and lampposts needed nails. Anderson's shop turned out almost 1,000 nails per day. So as you walk around town, consider the humble nail and the huge impact it had in building this town. After you consider that, add in the requirements of armies on the move during the Revolutionary War. Today, we can't imagine the hard work that was done here. It's no wonder that by the time of the war, the number of workmen and specialists had grown to some 40 men, working 12 to 14 hour days, toiling over 7 forges. And if that weren't enough, add in the production of such items as firearms, ammunition, knives, numerous tools, hardware for cavalry that included bits, stirrups, and spurs, hardware for artillery carriages, and hardware to house the soldiers, whether it was barracks or hospitals. Eventually, this complex consisted of at least 6 buildings, one of which was a tinsmith, the first in America. All of this made the Anderson Armory the largest industrial-type complex in town, and probably for many miles around. When the capital moved to Richmond in 1780, Anderson moved as well. However, he would resign his commission as public armorer shortly after the war ended and would eventually return to his shop in Williamsburg. By then, it was a decidedly smaller operation. The town was starting its slow decline, and history was moving on. Anderson died in 1798, but the property remained in the family for another 82 years. When the Great Fire of 1842 claimed this block of houses, Anderson's house was among those lost, but the family rebuilt the home and remained here until they sold it in 1880. By then, the property had been in the Anderson family for 110 years. After the sale, we see the lot and buildings change hands many times until 1932. 1932 was the year the property passed to Colonial Williamsburg. This home was also conveyed with a life estate, allowing the owners to remain in the house rent-free. Although reconstruction of the shop took place during the 1980s, this is one of the sites in town that has benefited from additional research and archaeology. In fact, of the 5 or so blacksmith shops that served Williamsburg, James Anderson's was the best documented of the sites. Armed with new information, the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation decided to demolish, then reconstruct the outbuildings, including the blacksmith and tinsmith buildings. That extensive work was completed in 2013. Let's continue our tour. The large building, coming up on your right, was originally built as a rental property. Today, it is the Brick House Tavern. The Brick House Tavern was built in the 1760s, basically for travelers, specifically for those who came to Williamsburg on business or for trade and who would stay for a few days or even a few weeks or longer. Tradesmen might visit Williamsburg and stay for a time to test the waters, so to speak, and determine if it was worth their time and effort to establish themselves in business here. According to historic research of the property, Richard and Mary Davis ran a lodging house here, opening in 1770. And typical of this type of lodging, accommodations were offered not just for people, but for their horses as well, a reminder of the important role of the horse in colonial life. An ad placed in the Gazette offered new stables and a large pasture remarkable for good grass and water. Another advertisement reminds us that not all travelers were men. The Davises made the point that the building had been divided, upstairs for the men and downstairs for the women. The advertisement stated, "Any ladies that may choose to spend a few weeks in private times, whether for pleasure or education, may do it here both reasonably and conveniently." Before we move on, be sure to step back and notice the symmetry of this building. It's a large and excellent example of architectural balance and symmetrical design so important in this era. Next, we're going to visit another of the popular stores in town, the Tarpley Store. The building is close by at the corner of Duke of Gloucester and Botetourt Streets. Tarpley's, established in 1759, was one of the earliest stores in Williamsburg. The merchant, James Tarpley, purchased this lot from Henry Wedderburn, who we'll see shortly. Tarpley operated his store for 5 years, until 1764, the year he died. Actually, after James Tarpley was here, various owners operated stores on this site, with one exception. In the 1770s, printer Alexander Purdy operated his Virginia Gazette here, one of the competing newspapers in town, all of which were named the Virginia Gazette. Even in the early years of America, merchants had to contend with those who did not pay their bills on time. In a friendly way, Tarpley reminded his patrons that they needed to pay their accounts on time by issuing the following statement in October 1775 in the Virginia Gazette. "Those persons who have been indebted to the subscribers longer than the usual time of credit will certainly be sued if they do not immediately discharge their accounts. We likewise sell rum, sugar, and molasses." One more note on James Tarpley. In 1761, Tarpley gave a bell for the bell tower at Bruton Parish Church. It remains in place today and is known as the Tarpley Bell. Next door to James Tarpley's store is another of the large taverns in town, Wedderburn's Tavern. So let's stroll over to that building. Let me ask you, what's the first thing you notice? Probably the unique color. Wedderburn's Tavern, one of the last properties to be acquired by Colonial Williamsburg, is one of the most important and unique buildings in town. Besides being one of the original buildings, meticulous accounts of the building itself and its contents over time make it one of the most thoroughly documented of Colonial Williamsburg's holdings. As we approach Wedderburn's, take a look at some of the exterior features. First of all, that all-important symmetry is very obvious here, sort of. But more about that in a minute. A building of this size and this color certainly makes it stand out from the other nearby structures. The tavern wasn't always this color, however. In early pictures, some of which you can still find around town, the color is white, and the building remained white until the restoration in the 1960s. More current research indicated that the original color was a dark red, called Spanish brown. So during the restoration, the color was corrected so that today we see the building as it looked during the colonial period. Another unique exterior feature that you can check out is the siding. The builder used planed, beaded weatherboards rather than the usual clapboards. Although not unique in town, you can see other such examples in nearby buildings. The beading seems to stand out more on this building, perhaps because of the color. The weatherboards are sawn, not split, and the beading produces a board that is grooved and has a lower edge that is round rather than the usual squared-off edge. These subtle differences give Weatherburns its unique look. In 1738, Henry Weatherburn purchased two lots, this property and the adjoining lot that he would sell to James Tarpley. At the time of the purchase, Weatherburn also ran the Raleigh Tavern across the street. Now, try to follow along with these transactions. Weatherburn came into ownership of Raleigh Tavern by way of marriage. His first wife, Mary, was the widow of the owner of the Raleigh. Very shortly after Mary's death, something like 10 days after her death, Weatherburn married Anne Shields, who was the daughter and widow of tavern keepers. Shields Tavern is just a few doors away. It appears Henry Weatherburn was certainly a canny businessman. Weatherburn hosted a variety of patrons here, from those arriving for court activities or business at the Capitol, to visitors to the college, members of the House of Burgesses, and members of the council. Weatherburn's tavern accommodated all patrons with private dinners, public rooms for food and drink, and nightly entertainments. In April 1757, a committee from the town council met here to plan for the construction of the Market House over on Market Square. Weatherburn's tavern was so successful that he decided to expand his property, adding a ballroom. This great room, as it was called, was a very popular feature. Residents enjoyed lectures, balls, and gatherings known as assemblies, where they could socialize and dance the night away. Weatherburn was able to add a ballroom because of one additional unique feature of this building. The structural framework used heavy girders and roof trusses. These were expensive architectural features and are quite rare in town. However, that framework allowed Henry Weatherburn to expand his tavern. The framework of the original section of the building and that of the addition are so similar that architects believe the same builder was responsible for both. Step back and take a look at the building. You can see the original part of the building, which is the section on your left, with the door in the center. The extension, which is the great room, is on the right. Also, notice that the chimneys are not at the ends of the roof, but instead are in the middle. This design provided for a fireplace in each of the four interior rooms. One more thing, the roof itself is unique. The design is called a jerkinhead roof. Looking at the top of the roof, you can see that the ends, instead of being straight, are wedged, creating an angle. It is the only such example of this type of roofline that remains in Williamsburg. With such a large operation, it's obvious that Weatherburn, and whichever wife was with him at the time, could not run such an establishment by himself. Henry Weatherburn owned 12 slaves. His two most important slaves were his stable manager, Caesar, and his cook, who we believe was named Sylvia. Not only were Caesar and Sylvia valuable to the household, they held very important positions at the tavern as well. Without them, you can bet that Weatherburn would not have been nearly as successful as he was. Weatherburn's tavern was restored in the mid-1960s. Just about all of the brick foundations, the framing, and the interior floors are original. Before we go, if you'd like to see the dividing point between the old building and the ballroom, take a close look at the doorway on the right. Just to the left of the door, there is a thin wooden strip called a beaded corner board, and that strip marks the wall between the old building and the addition. Okay, we're ready to move on. Since you've probably heard just about enough of taverns, we're going to make quick stops at the two final taverns on this tour, starting with the King's Arms. Along the way, though, we're going to pass by the home and shop of Edward Charlton. Edward Charlton was a wig maker, also known as a peruke maker, who kept a shop across the street next door to the Raleigh Tavern. He was married to Jane Hunter. Jane and her sister Margaret ran Margaret Hunter's millinery shop, which is also across the street. Wigs were expensive and therefore were worn only by the wealthy. One of Edward Charlton's popular wigs was called the Brown Dress Bob Wig, which sold for the princely sum of £2.03. Wigs for men were a large part of Charlton's business, but he also provided curls for the ladies, and among his other services, he offered shaving and hairdressing. In the pre-Revolutionary War years, there were something like 15 wig makers here in town. Perhaps Charlton's was one of the better shops, because listed in his account books are such prominent men as George Washington, Patrick Henry, and George Wythe, and his student Thomas Jefferson. By the time of the Revolution, though, wigs were going out of style, particularly among the young male population, including Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. You'll notice that portraits of Jefferson and Washington from that time show them with their natural hair. We're going to continue up the street to the King's Arms and then Shields Tavern, so feel free to have a seat near either tavern while we discuss both of these businesses and how they've changed over the years. The King's Arms Tavern that we see today is not the tavern that existed at the time of the Revolutionary War. There used to be two separate buildings here, but now the property consists of one continuous structure on this lot. In 1772, Jane Vaube added to the genteel establishments in town when she opened the King's Arms. 1772. Her timing couldn't have been better. She counted among her customers many of the men over at the Capitol, the men arguing for and against independence. As you sit here, you can just see them coming and going during the day and into the evening, meeting in the Capitol, visiting homes of the distinguished town residents, small groups meeting in the street. And all the while, you can see Jane Vaube and probably a small army of slaves and servants keeping food and drink available for all. Then, during the war, her small army catered to the large army as American troops were provided meals here throughout the war. There is a story that General von Steuben's bill totaled almost $300 in Spanish coin for his lodging and meals and, no doubt, care for his horse and the horses of his soldiers. Before Mistress Vaube opened her tavern, the adjoining lot, the lot on the left, had been sold to Alexander Purdy. Do you remember Alexander Purdy, the owner of the newspaper? We talked about Purdy a little while ago over at Tarpley's store. By 1774, he had established the third newspaper in town, the Third Virginia Gazette. And you know, you have to wonder whether this was a competitive scheme or a lack of imagination. After all, there were plenty of other names available for newspapers, so why this small town had to have three papers with the same name is an interesting point to ponder. Anyway, today, the building that was Alexander Purdy's home is now part of the King's Arms Tavern. Although they sat next to each other, King's Arms and Shields Taverns catered to distinctly different groups. Where King's Arms served the elite members of colonial America, Shields catered to the middling class, travelers and merchants. Shields Tavern represents one of the very earliest ordinaries in town. Williamsburg had coffee houses within the first 10 years after the town was established. That would be from 1700 through 1710. Within that decade, probably around 1707, John Marat, who was a tavern keeper and who happened to be James Shields' father-in-law, built on this site. By 1740, James Shields had acquired the tavern and the business. Although both men were tavern keepers, according to the record, the name of the business on this site was the English Coffee House. Shields died in 1750, and it appears that the name wasn't changed to Shields Tavern until after his death, when his wife Anne took over. Anne Shields ran the business for one or two years after that. In 1752, she married again. Do you remember who she married? Henry Wedderburn. I would like to have been the attorney who handled these property transactions. By the late 1700s, a doctor lived here. His name was John de Sequeira, and he was the visiting physician at the public hospital over on the other side of town. Dr. Sequeira was the town's only Jewish resident. The tavern today represents that time when the Shields family operated the business. This is one property in town that continues to have a variety of uses dictated by the needs of the foundation. At times, it has served as offices for Williamsburg, and at one time served as a mortuary. It has been a tavern, it was closed for a time, it became staff housing, then opened as a tavern again in the early 2000s. So, by the time you see the building, it may or may not be a tavern. The next house up the street is actually the last house on Duke of Gloucester Street, the impressive John Palmer House. John Palmer was an attorney here in town, and at one time he also served as the bursar, or treasurer, over at the College of William and Mary. But before Palmer arrived, another person lived here. According to the historic records, Alexander Kerr purchased a house that existed on this site in 1732, paying £100 for the property. Look at the house, then look at the large brick building to your left at the end of the street. That's the Capitol. Look how close the Palmer House is to the Capitol. I point this out because apparently in 1736, the House of Burgesses brought a complaint against Alexander Kerr. It seems that Kerr wanted to have some bricks made and had set up a brick oven on the premises, but the location of the oven was actually on the lot occupied by the Capitol. Calling it a nuisance, the Burgesses demanded that the directors of the city remove the offending structure. It's very possible that the oven was to be used to make bricks for a new house. When Kerr died in 1738, the property was advertised for sale, and at that time, the advertisement included the description, "A well-finished brick house in good repair." And by then, the property also included a store, coach house, stables, office, and a large garden, quite an extensive property located on a very desirable lot in town. Enter attorney John Palmer. Sometime before 1749, Palmer acquired the property, but in 1754, another catastrophic fire occurred on this side of the street and burned a number of buildings, including John Palmer's house. According to contemporary accounts, it was one of the worst fires Williamsburg had ever seen. Not long after that, however, Palmer rebuilt, and this is the house we see today. If you compare this building to any of the others we've seen thus far, you may notice that it is different in style. In fact, this house is an excellent example not of colonial-era architecture, but of the designs you'd see in the city of London at the time. You might recognize this type of brickwork. It's used throughout Williamsburg. The brick pattern is known as Flemish Bond. But look closely and you'll see holes in the walls. If you're here during the Christmas season, you'll find apples placed in those holes, a long tradition for this house. The holes are leftover features from the time the house was built. They are called put-log holes. As the workmen building the house added layer upon layer of brick, they used scaffolding. And what supported the scaffolding? Wooden beams. And the ends of the beams created holes in the brick pattern. Usually the holes were filled in after the building was completed, but sometimes they weren't, as you see on this house. We know that it took about 25 years before the holes were finally filled in. But then, when the house was being restored, the mortar was removed, keeping the house the way it looked when it was first built. During the Civil War, John Palmer's house was used as headquarters, first by the Southern Army, and then, when the Northern troops took over the town, they took over the house as well. A captain in the Union Army, named David Cronin, who was stationed here, looked into the distant future when he stated that an air of venerable prestige pervades the town, and this will always render it attractive and inspiring to lovers of history. The Palmer House is another of those homes that's not part of Colonial Williamsburg's historic interpretation, but it's an interesting house. From the Palmer House, let's walk toward the final stop on our tour, the Capitol. To see the front of the Capitol, you'll want to enter the grounds, then walk to the right side of the building. It's the side with the rounded ends. While we walk toward the Capitol grounds, we're going to talk about something that you can't see. No building marks this spot. There are no foundations or fences to look for. There are no marks of any kind denoting this area. But nevertheless, this was one of the most important spots in town. You're walking near the area that was once called the Exchange. The Exchange would have been off to your left between the Secretary's office and Charlton's Coffee House, which we visited during part one of the tour. Similar to the beginnings of Wall Street in New York City, the Exchange here in Williamsburg was a colonial-era commodities market, where businessmen, traders, and merchants met to determine the price of their goods, the price of tobacco, for instance, and to trade their commodities for paper notes known as commercial paper. Besides pricing goods, they were also taking on risk in betting on the future price of those goods. In the 1730s, a new type of property was introduced into the area, the property of slaves. So slaves were also priced and traded here as well. Okay, let's turn to our final stop, the Capitol. To see the unique design of this building, walk around to your right. You'll be viewing the south side of the building, the side with the rounded ends. The Capitol building in Williamsburg is like an early version of the United States Capitol in Washington, D.C. If you visited the U.S. Capitol, you know that the building has two distinct wings, one for the House of Representatives, the other for the Senate. Here in Williamsburg, we see a colonial building that also had two distinct wings, one for the Royal Governor's Council and the other for the House of Burgesses. Except, this is not the way the building looked when those two groups met in the 1760s, in the years just before the Revolution. The design you see now is the design of the first Capitol, which burned down. When the second Capitol was built, instead of retaining those unique rounded ends, the sides were squared off. What you're looking at is actually the third Capitol, built to look like the first Capitol. One more thing that you may notice, there are no chimneys. Fireplaces raised a fear of, well, fire, so they were eliminated. However, within 20 years after the building was completed, the council had decided that rectifying the dampness of the humid summers and the cold of the dry winters was more important than the risk of having fireplaces. So, in the 1720s, we see fireplaces along with their chimneys. But then, 20 or so years later, you know it was only a matter of time, that fear became a reality when the building burned to the ground. If you're wondering why Colonial Williamsburg used the first design of the Capitol for the reconstruction, it's because there is little information about the second building. However, because of a bit of good luck, detailed plans of the first building were discovered. But before we get to that point, let's go back to the beginning. In the Act of 1699, the Colonial House of Burgesses, who had been meeting at the old Capitol at Jamestown, decreed that a new building should be constructed at the new location known as Middle Plantation, the place that would become Williamsburg. The Act stated that the new building should be known as the Capitol. This was the first time in America that the name Capitol would be used for such a meeting house. So what provided the information for this building to be rebuilt? For that, we go to Great Britain, to Oxford University, and the Bodleian Library. By sheer luck, an engraved copper plate from 1740 was discovered at the Bodleian Library in 1929, just as John D. Rockefeller and Dr. William Goodwin were hatching the plan for Colonial Williamsburg. The plate offered a detailed description of three of the main buildings at Williamsburg during the 1740s. One of the buildings detailed was the Capitol. When the Bodleian Library presented the copper plate to Rockefeller, he stated that it was to serve as the basis to rebuild the Governor's Palace, the Wren Building at the College, and the Capitol. He went on to say that without the rare and valuable plate, and I quote here, they would have been acting in the dark. The first Capitol building was begun in 1701, and by 1704 it was pretty much complete. The Governor's Council moved in first in 1704. They occupied the chamber on the left or west side of the building. The following year, the Burgesses moved in across the hall to occupy the east side of the building. By the way, the Governor's Council consisted of 12 men appointed by the king for life, and the Burgesses were the representatives of the colonies. When the two sides could not agree on a piece of legislation, select members of both sides would meet in the atrium, the area between the two chambers. And disagree they did. Here in 1765, Patrick Henry railed against the Stamp Act. Here in 1775, in reaction and fellowship with their fellow patriots in Boston after the Tea Party, the Burgesses declared a day of humiliation, prayer, and sacrifice. And here, in the spring of 1776, members adopted a document written by George Mason that would be known as the Virginia Declaration of Rights. This document profoundly influenced another document that was soon to be written, the Declaration of Independence. Here, the walls literally rang with the voices of revolution and American freedom. What about the workmen, the men who built this Capitol? I have a couple of stories that I'd like to share. There was a brickmaker, a man named John Tulett, who, under contract, was to make 600,000 bricks priced at 20 shillings for each brick. The workers who would make those bricks had to be housed and fed. That sounds easy enough if you remember that a number of taverns were nearby, so the workmen could eat there, right? Wrong. They were not allowed to patronize the taverns. There was a law at that time that we would consider odd today that prohibited any tavern keeper from providing these workers with food or drink unless the tavern had received a specific license to do so. Because of this, the contractor was ordered to purchase barrels of pork along with bushels of peas and corn. So, for the time that the building was being built, that is what the workmen ate, pork, peas, and corn. Another of the workers, a carpenter named James Whitby, had hired an apprentice in 1711, an orphan named Owen Morris. As was tradition, at the end of his apprenticeship, Morris would receive a payment and tools valued at £6. That would have allowed the illiterate orphan to set himself up in his own trade. Whitby, however, died the following year, and apparently nothing was provided for young Morris, so we don't know what happened to him. We can only hope that another carpenter took him in, allowing him to continue his apprenticeship and have a better life. Just as the earliest capital of Virginia at Jamestown had moved inland, the capital will move again further inland to Richmond. The final meeting at this capital was on Christmas Eve, 1779. Virginia's government moved to Richmond the following year. After the government moved, the building was repurposed, to use a modern term, and used at various times as a hospital and a school. By 1794, the east side had been demolished and the debris sold to pay the expenses for the rest of the building. Upkeep expenses were no longer needed by the 1830s, however, because in 1832, another fire destroyed what remained of the great historic building. After the capital moved, the town, along with this once bustling area, fell into a long slumber. While the country grew and many areas prospered, Williamsburg would be left behind until John D. Rockefeller arrived on the scene to raise the colonial town again. Reconstruction of the Capitol building began in 1931. By 1934, it was complete and once again would become the eastern anchor of the town at the end of mile-long Duke of Gloucester Street. With our visit to the Capitol, we've reached the final stop on part two of Bright Path Tours' visit to Colonial Williamsburg, and I want to thank you for taking this walk with me today. As you continue your visit, remember one man, Dr. William Goodwin, who back in the 1930s had a dream to restore a few buildings in his hometown. And remember that small group of men, backed by millionaire John D. Rockefeller, who arrived armed not with shovels and backhoes, but with pad and pencil, and began the arduous task of rebuilding a town that had all but disappeared. Who would have thought that the vision of that team would result in a completely restored Colonial Williamsburg, the town where American independence began? Thank you for downloading this tour. If you're staying for a few days, or if you plan to return, I hope you'll join Bright Path Tours again. Until then, I hope you'll enjoy the rest of your visit to Colonial Williamsburg, and I bid you good day.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.